This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 18 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Zachary Frühling. In this episode, we're going to be talking about games, and not just any game, but poker. And not just any game of poker, but the poker game that's played on the Enterprise-D. We'll be talking about poker as a metaphor for life in general and how it helps to cultivate desirable traits in Starfleet officers. We'll also be talking about game theory ethics and some well-known examples such as the Prisoner's Dilemma. Zachary, that hoodie and those dark sunglasses you have on, do you think that's going to enhance your poker face for the episode today?
Yeah, I've got my poker face on and I'm ready to bluff my way through the episode.
All right. This is going to be a fun one. It's amazing how synonymous poker is to Star Trek, certainly in the Star Trek universe. I know in preparing for the episode, I was surprised at just how many TNG episodes, but not just TNG, but literally every iteration of Star Trek from the original series all the way through. There have always been poker references, games of poker played. It's pretty synonymous with Star Trek. What are your thoughts?
Well, I chuckled to myself a little bit as I was preparing for the podcast today, because it seems a little odd to me, even preparing for the show, to have a Star Trek and philosophy podcast where we're going to talk about poker. But the idea for the topic came up in a recent episode that I did with our editor and producer, Dennis Costello. He and I did an episode of From There to Here, Trek FM's 50th Anniversary Rewatch podcast last week. We were talking about the original series episode, The Corbomite Maneuver, and that's in episode 55 of From There to Here, if you're interested in listening to Dennis and me talk about the Corbomite Maneuver. But in that episode of the original series, there's an interesting discussion about whether the situation that Kirk and Spock and the rest of the crew in is that situation similar to the game of chess, you know, a game of logical deduction? And Spock makes the claim that situation they're in is a game of chess. And Kirk says it's more like a game of poker. And that got me thinking that there's an awful lot of poker inside of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking, you know, it's a really interesting metaphor for life. I think, you know, being able to bluff your way through life is a good skill. It's a metaphor for being a Starfleet officer, the things you learned to do and the role of a starship captain. And there's an awful lot of it in Star Trek, so there's plenty of examples to talk about. And it's sort of loosely related to different ethical examples that we can talk about, from virtue ethics in the sense of developing character traits. And it's also related to some game theory examples. Specifically, I'm thinking of things like the Prisoner's Dilemma that we're going to talk about in a little bit. So as I started thinking about it, it occurred to me there's actually an awful lot to talk about with poker. And I'm not a poker player myself, so I'm actually bluffing my way through this. Not joking.
Well, it's funny because oftentimes poker became a metaphor for the particular episode that you're watching, or some aspect of the poker game itself. And as you mentioned, it might have been the bluff. It might be the style of poker that's being played. That come up in a couple of episodes, and it's interesting because they end up using that as a jumping point for the episode. And if you really are paying attention, you discover that poker game really was a metaphor for the dilemma that they found themselves in during the episode. So it's a lot of fun, certainly in a Star Trek universe. I play a little poker. I'm by no means a great poker player.
I thought you had a poker face. Yeah. I could tell you were a poker player, just like Dr. Mendoza could tell that Riker was a poker player.
Poker? What's poker? Well, Zachary, before we deal hands and get started with the episode, we received a new iTunes review in the American store. We received a 5-star rating from CB Spock on February 21st. CB Spock says, "Where was this show when I was in college taking philosophy? Discussion of philosophical topics using Star Trek as examples. They discuss the message and meaning behind Star Trek and specific episodes and films." Well, CB Spock, we're so glad that you listen to Metatrex, and thank you for leaving us the rating and review on the iTunes store. And just a reminder to our listeners, we'd love to hear your feedback, certainly through the Babel Conference on iTunes. If you hit the subscribe button, that helps us tremendously. Leave us a star rating and a review. We would appreciate that. And we might even read yours right here on the podcast. Zachary, what do you think? CB Spock says he needed this when he was in college.
You know, I'm always a little amazed that I'm amazed, first of all, that people take the time to listen to us each and every week. You know, it's just you and me as two talking, not even talking heads, talking voices in their podcast headphones. Mm-hmm. And much less take the time to leave us a review. I mean, people are listening to us and like us, what we're doing here on Metatrex, enough to take the time to leave us an iTunes review. And of course, I'm just incredibly satisfied that listeners out there are getting what we're trying to do with combining Star Trek and philosophy and using the best of both worlds to expose the best in the other. Right? You know, we're using the best of philosophy to expose some of those deeper issues in Star Trek and using Star Trek as a way of getting into those tricky issues in philosophy that could be a little boring in a traditional setting. So we're really doing something new here. I'm glad it's translating to people. So again, just thank you for taking the time to leave us a review. And if you're listening to this and you haven't taken the time to leave us a review in iTunes, please take just 30 seconds out of your day to leave us a star rating and a review on iTunes. We may read your review here on the podcast. If you have any feedback or suggestions for the show, we're all ears, and we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show and for what we could do on the show. So if you haven't taken the time to leave us a review of Metatrex on iTunes, please take 30 seconds out of your day to do that. It's one of the best things you can do to help us out. There's some weird search algorithm that iTunes uses to let other people find the shows when they search for something in iTunes. So the number of star ratings, the number of iTunes reviews really do make a difference. So please take the time out of your day to do that. If you do nothing else to help us out on Metatrex, just take the time to leave us a star rating and a review. We'd really appreciate it. It's one of the best things you can do to help us out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Zachary, our editor and producer, Dennis Castello, has shuffled the deck with the speed and precision of an android, and cards are being dealt. So shall we begin?
Except if Dennis has shuffled the deck, I know it's stacked and it's coming up all threes. I don't trust it. I don't trust it. it's like when... I forget which episode this is in, but someone accuses Geordi of cheating with his visor.
Yes, yes. I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Do you know which episode that is?
that's Ethics, believe it or not, which, you know, perfect title to bring up Geordi's ability to cheat with his visor. And I like how Geordi kind of passes it off. He doesn't look until after the hand's been played.
After the hand is over, right.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that you can hear Data kind of cough in the background. Bullcrap, you know?
Yeah, that's all part of his bluff, right? Yeah. Speaking of ethics, yeah.
Speaking of ethics.
Well, but before we dive in to talk about, you know, the meaning of poker in Star Trek, I this morning I did take a little bit of time to try to put together a list of poker episodes in Star Trek The Next Generation. And I focused specifically on Star Trek The Next Generation because I think that is what most people think of when they think of poker in Star Trek. You can certainly find examples of poker in Deep Space Nine and in Voyager, and we mentioned the original series already. Mm-hmm. But there's countless examples of poker inside The Next Generation, so much so that it's an ongoing theme for The Next Generation. Maybe even it's a way of capturing the overall arc of The Next Generation. I think, you know, the fact that they use poker as the very last scene of Star Trek The Next Generation lends some credence to the idea that poker is used as a metaphor throughout the entire series. So I did put together a list of episodes, and I'm not sure if this is an exhaustive list, mainly because I ran out of time and I didn't have time to do a thorough, exhaustive search for every reference to poker inside The Next Generation. But this list should have some of the highlights. So first of all, I've got Measure of a Man. And in that episode, Data doesn't understand the practice of bluffing. And just like Spock has to be convinced that poker is different than chess, you know, Data's has to learn this development that you can't just... Poker's not just about following the rules. It's about learning to bluff. And when you try to follow the rules of poker and the mathematics of poker, you know, that's not how you win a game of poker. Mm-hmm. Data has to learn that. The next thing I've got on my list is the emissary. And in this episode, Riker points out that Worf has been the biggest winner of the day, and kind of implying that Data shouldn't underestimate his poker skills. Data doubts that Worf's success is due to anything other than random chance, and Pulaski, being the only one who doesn't fold, calls Worf's hand. And, of course, Worf wins, and Worf really dominates the poker scene in this episode. On a subsequent hand, Worf bets again. LaForge says he's bluffing, and Worf insists that Klingons never bluff. And this is a great example of, remember when we were talking about Klingon virtue ethics a few episodes ago? We had a list of things Klingons don't do. Klingons never bluff. And one of my favorite lines from The Next Generation is in this episode. Worf says,
"Talk or play, not both."
That's so great.
Great poker
episode.
That's great.
You know, it was discussed in production that when writing poker into the episodes, the Klingons should not be allowed to win. And I think probably somebody took a
don't let the Klingon win, or let the Klingon win.
Just like took a page from Star Wars.
Let the Wookiee win.
Right. let the Klingon win. I really enjoy, and I think it is cause and effect when Worf's playing poker with the group. And yeah, I get a kick out of the way Data is dealing the cards, and he says, you know, nothing there for the Klingon. It was almost derogatory.
And Worf gives him a dirty look.
Just gives him a dirty look. Which
Worf is disgusted by that comment. Nothing there for the Klingon.
That would have been a great time for you know, if you were any other man, I'd kill you where you stand.
If you were any other android, and if you had a better hand, I would kill you where you stand.
Another reference to bluffing, while we're talking about bluffing, is referenced in Data's Day. Also, I should mention that shadows and symbols from Deep Space Nine. I know we're focusing on the Next Generation, but another great reference to bluffing. Admiral Ross says to Major Kira, "Remind me never to play poker with you." Referencing her ability to bluff her way through a tough situation. I think bluffing is probably a prerequisite for Starfleet officers.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, how many times do we see Starship captains having to bluff their way through a situation? So, absolutely.
I think poker might be a required class at the academy. Maybe Boothby teaches poker at the academy. He's not just the groundskeeper. He's the poker professor.
Actually, a rite of passage for junior officers is to have to bluff their way into the senior officers' poker game.
And we know that we know from Lower Decks that junior officers have their own game.
Yeah, that's how you earn your promotion, right? Once you've been accepted, you get your stripes. I love that in that episode, Deanna points out the fact that Riker could have been seen by his superiors as having, brown nosed his way into the poker game a little bit to ingratiate himself with his superiors, and just like he's accusing Lavelle of doing in the junior officers game.
But again, you know, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if poker isn't something that is encouraged at the academy. I think about some of the references, you know, throughout Star Trek. Archer in Rogue Planet mentioned playing a game of poker at Jupiter Station. One of my favorites, Hoshi. Hoshi broke her CO's arm over a dispute because she was running a poker game for new Starfleet Academy recruits.
And she can play poker in any language.
She can play poker in any language. Voyager episode, The Collective. We see a poker game. They play poker on the Delta Flyer. I mean, it's everywhere.
Wow, that's really more than I realized. I really was focusing just on The Next Generation, but that's quite a few references.
Yeah, it's everywhere in the Star Trek universe. And so, you know, I'd really be interested to explore even maybe in the novels and the comic books and just see, even out there in the non-canon sources, you know, just how often they bring poker up in Star Trek.
Well, let's keep running through our list of Next Generation episodes. We've got quite a few more to go through. We'll do it really quickly.
Yeah.
So we covered Data's Day already. In that episode, Data compares Captain Picard's refusal to retreat to bluffing in poker. So clearly by the time Data's Day rolled around, Data learned the lesson that bluffing is an important skill. We've got the episode The Price, and in that episode, Dr. Mendoza recognizes that Riker is a poker player. We've got The Outcast, and in that episode, Worf calls Counselor Troy's Federation Day variant on poker a, quote, woman's game, because it supports a weak hand. So we'd love to get the Women at Warp podcaster's opinion on Worf's take on poker here. We've got The Best of Both Worlds, and in that episode, Commander Riker invites Admiral Hansen to poker night, but he replies that Commander Shelby has played a hand or two, and of course, Commander Shelby joins the weekly poker game. Riker bluffs to Wesley Crusher in that game, but ultimately Shelby wins the game, showing up Riker for once. And not too many people can do that at poker. Riker's got a mean poker face, so Shelby one-ups Commander Riker.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting to me, while we're talking about that, it's amazing that that's a way of building credibility and character development, right? Shelby is out to get a promotion. She's out to win, and she's a card shark. And the fact that she can one-up Riker at his own game, that one little scene does a huge amount of character development for Commander Shelby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it shows her drive and determination without a doubt.
Absolutely. And that smile at the end, you know, she knows she's got him, and she's enjoying every second of it.
And for that matter, it sets up the whole play that, you know, quite possibly she could outmaneuver Will Riker for the first officer job on the Enterprise.
Absolutely. So in the episode Descent, we've got Data playing poker with Einstein, Newton, and Stephen Hawking in one of the most absurd holodeck scenes in Star Trek history, I think.
Oh, I disagree completely. That's one of my favorite holodeck scenes. I love that scene.
As if, you know, their skills at science give them any ability to play poker whatsoever. You know, clearly the writers thought this was important in some way, but it strikes me as a really
There's something
connection.
Joyfully ridiculous about it, indeed.
I'll grant you that. It's joyfully ridiculous, but it is on the ridiculous side. Of all the things you could do in a holodeck, speaking of a holodeck, of course, last week we talked about media ecology with our editor and producer, Dennis, and we spent a lot of time talking about the holodeck. Of all the things you would choose to do on a holodeck, why would you choose to play poker with Einstein, Newton, and Stephen Hawking on the holodeck? I can think of 100 other things I would rather do.
But you know that...
Even with Einstein, Newton, and Hawking, I can think of 20 better things to do with those three than play poker.
But you know, the interesting thing is why he had created this holodeck program, why he was playing poker with these three historical figures. You know, the whole purpose was, you know, Data wanted to explore human nature. He thought that this would be an interesting form for the study of human nature. So, you know, he's using poker to do that. And so he gets Einstein, Newton, and Hawking. And, you know, what a diverse group of people to sit and play poker with and debate philosophy. As a philosopher, Zachary, I'm surprised that, you know, you just don't geek out all the way around about this episode.
I love it, but I'm thinking, you know, if you really want a diverse crowd, why wouldn't you get like Gandhi in there? You know, are three scientists really the most diverse crowd of humans you could find? Even, you know, they all excel, but they're all excelling at something that's largely similar. Right?
They're bitter because he didn't invite Immanuel Kant to the game.
Kant! So we're only like 2/3 of the way through this list. We've got more to go. We've got
it's incredible.
We've got Time's Arrow, and in that episode we see Data playing poker in the 19th century, and of course he
with Gul Dukat.
That's right. I had forgotten he's in that episode.
Frederick LaRocque.
You know, I've watched that a million times, and I've seldom noticed that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, great episode. Great poker game. I like how Data even won some of their clothing. That was humorous.
He cleans house. Yeah, Data's learned how to play poker over the years, right?
Yeah. So when Frederick
now he knows he's not just bluffing. He is cleaning house.
Yeah. When Frederick LaRocque says he lost his shirt in a poker match, he really did.
But do you think Data won outright, or did he stack the deck? We know he can stack the deck because he's done that before, right? We get all cards being dealt as the number three inside the episode Cause and Effect. So we know he can do it, right? Do you think he won honestly, or did he really stack the deck in that game?
You know, in my head canon, I've got to believe that he won honestly. And the reason I say that is by this point in time, Data's become quite a card player. Not only has he mastered, you know, kind of the mathematical aspect of the game, but he's also discovered that he's a heck of a bluffer. And I think he went, you know, certainly when Jack London says to him that, you know, the poker game, and he's poker. I think he knows that.
And moreover, he seems to know the street value of the carbon, beryllium, and gold inside of his communicator pin.
Evidently. Or he just didn't mind that Gal Dukat just took him to the cleaners on it. But it was certainly okay. enough for him to win the hand and the game.
So Time Zero was a great poker episode, of course. We've got the quality of life in that episode. The stakes are high. The men, if they lose, are shaving their beards. And Dr. Crusher, if she loses, is dyeing her hair. And of course, we don't get to see the outcome of that.
We just talked about this episode in a recent episode of Metatrex entitled Fair Pay for Exacomps. That was a great discussion about that particular poker game.
We didn't see any exocomps sitting at the poker table. I really, now that I think about it, I want to see an exocomp playing poker.
I think we should go back and
right
explore
there next
that.
To Einstein and Newton.
Yeah, I think we should go back and explore that episode. I mean, if we're going to give them fair rights, we should invite them to the poker table. That would have been a great ending scene to go back to the poker table and, you know, the two surviving exocomps have been invited to the game.
And again, you know, I know we want to talk about the philosophy here of poker here in just a minute, but it strikes me that it's no accident that something like poker shows up in a show about the exocomps, right? One of the key questions is, are the exocomps alive or are they sentient? Are they self-aware? And of course, the contrast between program behavior and what it takes to play poker is a stark contrast. So I think it's no accident that poker got included in an episode about that topic.
Sure. But you know, I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure I'd want an exocomp playing at my poker table, because how easy would it be for that exocomp to produce at the end of his appendage, you know, that one card that he needs to win the freaking hand?
Plus, they've got awfully deep pockets. They can just keep replicating poker chips.
Absolutely.
Mountains of poker chips. So, okay, we've got, we're almost done here. We've got Lower Decks, and in that episode, we see the senior officer's poker game versus the junior officer's poker game. The junior officers being Sam Lavelle, the Vulcan Torek, Sito Jaxa, Alyssa Ogawa, and of course, the 10 forward waiter, Ben. And I love that episode because I love the contrast between the, it's really sort of cutting back and forth between the junior officer's game and the senior officer's game, because, you know, Riker has got, you know, is convinced that he doesn't like Lavelle, and Counselor Troy's trying to tell him Lavelle's more like you than you realize. And the way they cut it back and forth between both of those actors in two different poker games is brilliant. Shows the parallel character traits of each of those, characters.
Yeah, Sam Lavelle is definitely Will Riker at the beginning proto Will at the beginning of his career. And, you know, Torek, never trust a Vulcan at the poker table. We already know that Sito Jaxa is a hustler. Ben's a waiter. He's a bartender. We know he's a hustler. Alyssa Ogawa, though, she didn't belong at that poker table. I just... she's too nice to play poker, you know?
Well, I don't know. She could be like the Silent Avenger. So, you
this
know,
is,
she,
this is true.
Yeah,
this is true.
She's doing it like guerrilla style.
Maybe we should have seen her cleaning up the poker table. That would have made that interesting.
Alyssa Ogawa, guerrilla poker player. So we also have the episode Cause and Effect. And in that episode, of course, the Enterprise is stuck in a time loop. And one of the ways they discover they're in a time loop is that Data ends up dealing a hand of poker. They play the same game of poker again and again and again. And towards the end, Data deals all threes, threes and threes and threes throughout this hand of poker. And that becomes a clue that is used to identify the fact that the crew is stuck inside of this this time loop. So we learn that Data can stack the deck. So that's the heart of my earlier question. We know Data can do it.
Yes. Expertly.
How do you ever trust him again, right?
That's a good question. I'm more likely to trust Data than I am Geordi and his visor, Mr. I don't look until the hand's over.
Right. You know,
Maloney.
Maybe next time you should bring a deck that's not transparent to infrared light.
Yeah, there's got to be some undercover cheating going on here in these poker games that we're not seeing on screen.
Hmm.
And finally, the last item on my list here is All Good Things, the last episode of The Next Generation, in which Picard finally joins the poker game. You know, after years of Picard not participating with his crew, not socializing with his crew very much, Picard finally decides to loosen up and join the poker game. And for me, that's a metaphor for things like community and friendship and Picard's overall character arc and character development throughout The Next Generation becomes a metaphor for the things that really matter most, in this 7-year journey that The Next Generation has had together as a crew.
Yeah, perfect ending for the series, in all honesty. I read a while back that Brandon Braga considered this to be the best script that he, a TV script that he had written. And I happen to agree. To bring Jean-Luc Picard into that poker game to kind of bring his character full circle. I mean, when we first meet him, he's very stiff. He's awkward around children. He's by the book. You know, we get to the middle of the series and he's starting to loosen up again. Once we get to Chain of Command, you know, you bring in another Starfleet captain who's by the book and almost makes Picard look lackadaisical. And then we get to All Good Things and Picard embraces his place as part of the community, part of the family. And I love the last line of that episode. He's dealing the cards and he says, five card stud, nothing wild. And the sky's the limit. I love it. And I think that's a metaphor for Star Trek. The sky's the limit, man. The sky's the limit.
As Scotty would say, it brought a tear to me eye.
It brought a tear to me eye. So I raised a glass to me lips, Lottie.
So finally, I have one last honorable mention. It's a non-poker episode, but it's poker-like. There's the episode Peak Performance in the second season of TNG when Data loses at a game of Stratagema to Sirna Kilrami. Despite making all the correct moves, he still loses the game. And Data has to learn that lesson with poker. He has to learn it with Stratagema. It's not poker, but it's poker-like.
Yeah. And if you're going to throw that in there, then I get my Way of the Warrior from DS9. Where O'Brien says to Worf, it's darts, it's like poker, but with pointy tips.
You think Worf would understand that?
Absolutely. I personally,
poker with sharp objects.
Personally, if you recall
poker
him
with
throwing
bat-lets.
That... Yeah, if you recall him throwing that dart, he sunk the whole thing into the wall. I mean, I would not want to play darts with that man.
Now I'm sort of envisioning like a poker, darts, bat-leth mashup contest. No, it's like American Gladiators, but you know, with games on the Enterprise.
Yeah, I think I'd just stick with cards.
Starfleet Gladiators. I love it. So this is a lot of episodes, and so I know that was maybe a little tedious to go through all those episodes, but it's really important to see there's a lot of poker inside of Star Trek. But it all started for me with this discussion about the Corbomite maneuver in the original series and the discussion that takes place about the difference between chess and poker. And that got me thinking there's something really to this idea that it's an important skill to learn, not for the sake of playing poker itself, but because it's a question of character development. In learning to master a game like poker, you learn important features of human nature. And that's important for Spock. That's important for Data. It's important for maybe young Starfleet officers who are at the academy. It's important for those junior officers to learn to bluff their way well, whether it's into the senior officer's poker game or whether it's, you know, bluffing with a Romulan commander on the ship across your bow, right? You know, this is an important skill set. So this got me thinking about the connection between poker and virtue ethics. You know, we did an episode previously on Klingon virtue ethics in which we mentioned that virtue ethics is a category of ethical theories in which the goal is to cultivate virtuous character traits. It doesn't focus so much on right or wrong actions. It focuses on character traits that are ideal or should be desired, or better character traits than other character traits. And it just strikes me that poker is such an interesting way of cultivating certain character traits that are desirable inside the Star Trek universe. What do you think, Mike? Is this a leap or is this a good connection?
No, I think it's an excellent connection. There are so many aspects to the game of poker. And I said, I'm a casual player. We talked a lot about bluffing. I think that's the obvious. But one of the things that you learn when you're playing poker, and one of the reasons why bluffing is such an important aspect of the game, is that in order to be a good poker player, you have to be able to read your opponents at the table. You have to be able to discern, you know, what's going on in their head, what their next move's going to be, what they're holding in their hand. You've got to be able to read. And again, that's why bluffing becomes such an important aspect. I don't think it's a leap at all. I think there are many aspects of the game of poker that are essential in a good Starfleet officer.
It also strikes me that there's, this is kind of a standard dramatic trope, you could call it a pattern that's used. You know, you see this in old military movies, and I think you see it in real life, right? If you're fighting a war, if you're out there every day doing your duty, you need to kind of blow off steam. There's a lot of waiting time. You can't focus on the things that are stressful to think about. You need something like poker to as a distraction from everything else that's going on in your day. You know, sometimes those things aren't pleasant all the time. So, you know, there is this kind of character, the psychology of it, I guess. You know, there's a being down in the trenches aspect to it, right? You're all fighting the same war. You're all fighting, doing the same duty. It's very stressful, and you need a way to bind you together as a team and blow off some steam. And of course, poker just seems like a good way to do that. A good way as any, right? It doesn't take too much in the way of materials, just a deck of cards. And of course, you can, on the Enterprise, you can replicate as many card decks as you want. So that's not a big issue. But, you know, back in the military days, you used to be able to just put a deck of cards in your pocket and whip it out and play a game of poker while you're down in the trenches together. So it also has this sort of character development aspect. This we're all in the trenches together. It binds them together as a community. And that's what is so striking to me about the development of Captain Picard sitting down to play poker finally in the last season of the Next Generation. You know, that is a symbol that Picard has become part of the community. He's accepted himself as part of the group. And it maybe took him 7 years to do that, to accept himself as not just above the group, but part of the crew. And of course, you know, like we said, this is a question of virtue ethics. This is a matter of cultivating desirable character traits. And in virtue ethics, you know, that sense of community or that sense of relationship is an important aspect of virtues. That's not a question of sort of laying down hard lines like Kant would do about what's right or what's wrong. This is a question of building values. And one of the values that we have as people, and as definitely as Americans, or as we have as humans, and as we have as Starfleet officers inside Star Trek, one of those values is relationship and community, friendship, mm-hmm. Camaraderie, however you want to spell it out. That's an important character trait, and poker is as good a way to do that as any, I think.
Yeah, I think that can be said of games in general, and I don't want to sound like I'm belittling video gamers who, you know, play first person shooter games, you know, on the internet.
Be careful. I've been known to play a game or two.
No.
Commander Shelby, she's been known to play a hand of poker. I've been known to play a video game or two.
Well, I enjoy video games as well. That's why I want to preface this by saying I'm not belittling, you know, gamers who, you know, play first person shooter games with their buddies online. But there's something about getting together around a table with a game. We were talking in the Turbo Lift coming up here about playing Monopoly. You're a wicked Monopoly player. My wife Dorinda, my daughter Hannah, and I, ever since my daughter was old enough to play Candyland, you know, we would we make it a regular point to, you know, to get together and play games. I've got a closet full of them here at the
house.
I love
the idea that your daughter schools you at Candyland, by
the
way.
She schools me in candy. She's wicked at it, man. No mercy. You know,
that I'd like to see.
Talk about gorilla poker, gorilla Candyland. And I tell you, she's wicked at the game of life. It never fails. I mean, she's got, you know, people stacked on top of a kid has more babies and gets paid for them at the end of the game. She's wicked.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the game of life, because I had thought about that game earlier, and I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue. So
it was great until you added on the Enterprise. But I think this can be said of games in general, and we've oftentimes had friends over to play games, game night. I've got some very humorous stories and anecdotes of getting together with friends and just sitting down and playing a game, whether it's Monopoly or poker or, you know, whatever the game, Candyland, whatever the game may be, getting together and just playing a game. The community, the camaraderie, I think it's important. I think it's an important aspect of living life. I think it's something that, unfortunately, as a society, we've gotten away from a little bit. And I think it would do us well to sit down at a table and just build that rapport with one another and play a game.
Mike, as you were talking, our editor, Dennis Castello, sent us a message, an instant message, which he often does while we're recording. So I can't take credit for this idea, but Dennis says that he makes a really fascinating point about poker, and it sounds like he's played more poker than I have. he says that there's kind of a grittiness to poker, right? There's a mental toughness, right? You know, there's ups and downs, and you got to stick with it and hold that bluff no matter what cards are shown at you. And that developing the grittiness or the stick-with-itness is an important thing you have to learn to do when you're playing poker. There's kind of a mental grittiness or a toughness that good poker players learn to develop. And I'll have to take his word for it, not having played a lot of poker, but that sounds right. And you see that in Captain Picard. When Captain Picard is bluffing in the face of all odds against him, right, he will hold that bluff to the last photon torpedo, right?
Dennis has obviously never played Chutes and Ladders with my daughter.
Speaking of grittiness.
speaking of grittiness.
So what else can we talk about in terms of virtue ethics and poker? I mean, what does poker do for a starship captain? You know, why is it important? Why does this feature so prominently in Star Trek? And not just about life in general, because I think there's a lot of metaphors you can have for life in general. I think being able to fake it until you make it is an important skill. I mean, even something like doing this podcast. I never did a podcast before this. Now I'm doing a podcast. You know, I sort of feel like I bluffed my way into doing a podcast in a way. I think getting a job is like that. You show up, you don't feel like you're competent, you don't feel like you're qualified yet. You learn to do it while you're there. Mm-hmm. That's bluffing your way into a job. That's an important skill to be able to have the self-confidence to be able to do those things. So there's good life metaphors, but what about Star Trek in particular? What about being a starship captain is important? You know, what lessons can we learn from poker?
Well, I think we've seen this dozens of times, certainly in the Next Generation. You know, when that Romulan warbird decloaks off the port bow, and it's Tomalak, and you know he's up to no good, and he's playing poker, you're playing poker, you've got to be good at this game. Talk about, you know, going back to Dennis's point regarding, you know, the grittiness of it. It doesn't get any grittier than, you know, standing toe to toe with a Romulan who his sole purpose for being there is to get one over on you. I mean, if he can come up with a way to destroy your ship and take the pieces of its hull back to Romulus, he's going to do it. And it doesn't matter if you've got a rapport. It doesn't matter if you get together and drink Romulan ale like old buddies. He's got one thing in the back of his mind. You know, when's the first opportunity that I can take a piece of this hull back to Romulus and, you know, throw it down in the Senate chamber and say, I got him.
You know what I love about thinking about different kinds of games? We mentioned a few games. We mentioned chess. We mentioned Candyland. We mentioned the game of life. What's fun about these games is that they all seem to cultivate different kinds of character traits. And that kind of situational awareness about what kind of mode you should be in based on the situation at hand is a very important lesson to learn in life, I think. I mean, you know, as a starship captain, you need to think, you know, am I in adversarial mode? Am I in bluffing mode? Am I in outwit my opponent mode, or am I in diplomacy mode, right? Am I in partnership mode? You know, these are different, you know, interpersonal modes you have to be in. And it's very, very important to know which mode you should be in at any given point. If you make the wrong move, you know, you might have the lives of all thousand and however many, 1,024, how many people are in the Enterprise? 1,014?
Yeah,
Something like that. You know, you've got 1,000 lives in the balance. You know, your ship might end up as a prize in the Romulan Senate chamber, right? You have to be very careful. So just being able to know, you know, should I be in poker mode? Should I be trying to outbluff my opponent? Should I be in chess mode where I can make the best strategy moves? Should I be in diplomacy mode where it's in everyone's best interest to not play the game and to partner with each other you know, not be so adversarial. I think that's just being able to, I think this is part of the virtue of games. They teach you those different ways of interacting in a very safe environment.
Zachary, you use the word strategy, and I think that's a key word for the discussion. You know, when we talk about poker, you know, it is a game in which you've got to have solid strategy, and that strategy has to be flexible. I hate to invoke my inner Kenny Rogers, but you know, great old song from Kenny Rogers, "The Gambler." You've got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. And so, you know,
so now I want Brent Spiner to sing a version.
I would pay to see Brent Spiner sing a version of that.
Old
yes,
Yellow Eyes
dressed, singing dressed like he was on the holodeck in Fistful of Datas. So, but back to my point, it's a strategy thing. And, you know, we don't think about, we think about strategy when we're dealing with that warbird decloaking, but think about the mundane day-to-day of a Starfleet captain or a Starfleet first officer. Let's use Will Riker, since he's typically in charge of duty rosters and ship resources. You know, and we've seen this happen a few times in the course of Star Trek. You know, you've got, you know, two different scientific teams wanting to use the deflector array. And so you've got to have a strategy because you certainly don't want one team feeling left out or not feeling that their research isn't as important. So, you know, you've got to think about your battles, think about how to word things. You've got to, there's some diplomacy there. It's all about just day-to-day strategy in order to be a successful starship captain or starship first officer. For Will Riker, you know, the last thing he wants to do is make the stellar cartography people feel like, you know, their research isn't important, because, you know, then he loses their support and he doesn't get their best, and, you know, then he's having to swap crew out at the next starbase.
See, it's interesting because what you're describing to me sounds a bit more like chess than poker, actually, because it sounds like you're talking about some sort of, I mean, you have to do this as a manager. I know you're a manager. You have to do this as a starship captain. Mm-hmm. There's a way of sort of greasing the wheels, positioning all the pieces just so in order to get what you need done, right? You know, everything has to be running smoothly. All the disagreements have to be taken care of. All the resources have to be allocated. And this is more like, you know, chess piece arranging than it is poker to me. Now, there's a greasing the wheels aspect. I think, you know, helping diffuse the tension can be a matter of, you can certainly bluff your way into diffusing the tension and setting up those pieces. Mm-hmm. And it's not really a dichotomy, I think, but it sounds more like, manipulating people by arranging pieces.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. I think there's a definitely an analogy there to be made for chess, but, you know, even at the poker table, sometimes you have to be able to convince somebody to get out of a game, if you feel that their hand is maybe a little stronger and you're going to bluff, you kind of pick and choose who to talk smack to, mm-hmm. and who to grease, and that's an aspect of poker as well.
Yeah, I think the bluffing aspect is just so important, right? You convincing other people that your hand is either better than it is or better than theirs, right?
Yeah.
Right. You know, that's an important, I think that's just such an important skill for life. You can really get things done that way. You know, if there's any roadblocks in your way, any obstacles, you can, by convincing them you've got all the cards. And of course, it really is better to have the cards, right? And this is what's fascinating about poker. The best situation is to really have the cards, right? But a lot of the time you don't have the cards. And in that case, you want to make other people think you've got all the cards.
Sure.
At very least, you want to make sure they think your cards are better than theirs. And there is kind of this top dog aspect of poker that is a little self-destructive. I think it's not communal in the sense of it's not collaborative. It's not a partnership. You are really trying to outwit and outbluff all of your opponents. You're trying to take that top dog position no matter what. And so insofar as poker is a metaphor for virtue ethics, there is this sort of character development aspect of it that's very important. You know, it can be, it can develop that kind of gamesmanship. It can develop the intuition, the grittiness that Dennis mentioned. But it also has this downside. You know, it cultivates the desire to be a top dog, no matter what that opposition throws at you. And I think you see that trait in very ambitious people. It's no accident that Riker, you know, up until his role as first officer of the Enterprise, he was a careerist, right? He was a young officer on the rise, and poker helped cultivate that top dog careerist approach to life that he takes. And of course, what's interesting, you know, this is what's fascinating. It's an interesting counterpoint to the character development we see in Captain Picard. Riker's character development as it relates to poker is Riker has to learn that he doesn't have to be top dog all the time. He doesn't need that promotion to captain. He's happy on the Enterprise, and you see that take place, mid run of the Next Generation seasons. I'm thinking of The Best of Both Worlds when Riker is contemplating the promotion. He has to have this conversation with with Deanna in 10-4. He says, I'm happy where I'm at. And, you know, doesn't need that promotion to be captain. Maybe he's a little afraid of it, but that's a change for Riker. That's a development for up till then. He's been top dog, the young hotshot poker player officer.
And I'm glad you mentioned that. Great minds think alike. Cause I was thinking about that very thing. You know, we've referenced Riker as the, you know, the first officer that wouldn't sit down. And it's interesting how, for him, his career is somewhat of a poker game. You know, does he continue to throw his chips in? Does he continue to play as first officer? Does he tip his hand? Does he take the promotion? And, you know, it's interesting how, poker has a tendency to teach, patience. If you're going to be a good poker player, you've got to be patient. And some of the worst poker players I know are very impatient people, and that impatience is read at the table. So poker is a great way to teach patience, and you've got to have the patience not just to play a hand, but to stay in a game. And I think for Will Riker, poker it was that tool that he used to learn that trait of patience. To allow him to continue when he'd certainly had other opportunities. If he was as young and ambitious and antsy and, you know, as some young officers, he would have jumped at the first, first captain's post that he was offered, and that would have been the end of him. But Will Riker learned the art of patience playing poker, so he stayed in there and he learned, 7, 8, 9, 10 years on the Enterprise under Captain Picard, you know, until the point in time when, okay, you know, it's time for me to throw my chips down and show my hand and you know, take the Titan.
See, this makes me think that Picard's clone, Shinzon, from Star Trek Nemesis, would have been the ideal poker player because all those years spent under the lash of a Romulan guard taught him patience. Maybe they played a lot of Romulan poker.
I think you're right. As he's
Riemann poker.
Yeah, Riemann poker. As it occurs to me that
they play it in the dark.
Yeah,
they're not comfortable
in that
in the
scene
light,
where he's impaled and he's, he's pulling himself off of that spear and he's just, I mean, his poker face. I mean, his blood's all over that that rod and he's just he's not lost his poker face. He is the ultimate poker player.
Shinzon's poker face. I love it.
Shinzon's poker face.
Well, Mike, the last thing I want to talk about is an example from game theory known as the Prisoner's Dilemma. And as I was preparing for the show today, I was thinking, what connections can I make with poker and philosophy? Not just poker and Star Trek, poker and Star Trek and philosophy together. And it occurred to me that poker is a game. So why not talk about some game theory ethics? And I don't know a lot about game theory. It's used in economics for predicting various economics moves you can make, business moves and whatnot. But there's a well-known example called the Prisoner's Dilemma that's used in ethics to try to draw out our intuitions about how people react to certain conundrums, certain dilemmas, and what their choices are, how they evaluate consequences. And it's very interesting because what's fun about the example is the way in which our intuitions are just go counter to what people actually do. You know, looking at an example from the outside, you can see, okay, here's what someone should do in a certain situation. But when you're in that situation, you often make very different judgments. And the Prisoner's Dilemma is a great example of how, when you put yourself in a certain situation faced with different kinds of consequences, you can approach it in different ways. You can weigh consequences differently and then, make a choice. And sometimes that choice is not ideal based on your expectations of how other people are going to act or, you know, what the consequences really are. But are you familiar with the Prisoner's Dilemma, Mike? Is this new to you or have you encountered it before?
I am. I love cop shows, and we see this played out in just about every cop show there is. I'm very familiar.
Do you want to give the a summary of it, or do you want me to tackle it?
No, go for it.
So basically, the Prisoner's Dilemma, it's a pretty easy situation to understand. You can probably tell a Star Trek version of it. I don't know if I'm feeling that creative enough. You imagine two people stuck in the brig, right? That's the Star Trek version of this. But imagine there's two prisoners, and they've been arrested for a crime they committed, presumably together. There's a number of ways you can kind of set up the story. After the prisoners are separated from each other, they're each offered a deal and a choice to either confess or not confess, and with varying levels of consequences, depending on who confesses and who doesn't confess. So let's call them Prisoner A and Prisoner B, or Officer A or Officer B, and, Brigmate A, Brigmate B. So there's two prisoners, prisoner A and prisoner B. If both of them confess, each prisoner has to serve a 5-year prison term. It doesn't matter what the numbers are, but the relative weighting between these numbers matters. Let's call it 5 years if both prisoners confess that they committed the crime. If one prisoner confesses but the other prisoner doesn't, the prisoner that confesses gets only 1 year of prison time, while the person that doesn't confess gets 10 years of prison time. And mm-hmm. that goes both ways. So if prisoner A confesses but prisoner B doesn't, then prisoner A only gets 1 year, prisoner B gets 10 years, and vice versa. So it goes both ways. So those are two different possibilities there. And finally, the last possibility is that neither prisoner confesses. And if that case unfolds, each prisoner only gets a 2-year term as opposed to a 5-year term if both of the prisoners confess. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, you can try to make a little 2x2 grid and you can map out these possibilities. You know, each prisoner is along each axis, either confess or not confess, and you can draw out the consequences. And what's interesting is this is the psychology of it, right? From the objective third person standpoint, you can look at this and say, obviously the safest answer is for neither prisoner to confess. They should stick to their agreement not to confess to each other. They should partner up. They should collaborate. They should be co-conspirators, and neither one should confess and rat the other person out, right? Because that in that case, they're only going to get 2 years. If they both confess, they're going to serve 5 years. If one of them confesses and the other one doesn't, you run the risk of getting a 10-year sentence, and that's really bad. So from the outside, the best answer is to bite your tongue, zip your lips, and not confess and stick to your collaboration. But what's fascinating to me is kind of the first person standpoint. If you're one of the prisoners and you're thinking about what the other prisoner might do, you're thinking, oh my God, if he confesses and I don't, I might get 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. I better confess. And if both prisoners think that about the other, which they're likely to do because they've been separated, they can't talk to each other. You know, people, I think in general, are very skeptical about other people's intentions, other people's decision-making process. The rational thing to do would be to say, I should confess. And, prisoners would think that about the other. So what's interesting here is the rational thing to do is to be a co-conspirator, not to confess. But if that happens, then each prisoner is going to get a 5-year term instead of much less painful 2-year prison sentence. 2 years in the brig, right? Makes Tom Paris's 30 days in the brig look like child's play. So what's interesting to me about the prisoner's dilemma is that you can draw a lot of different consequences from it. I think one way you can approach the prisoner's dilemma is to think of it like a logical exercise, weighing consequences, very much mm-hmm. like a chess game, right? Which is the logical chess move to make in this scenario. And if you're approaching it that way, you might think, the worst case scenario is to be ratted out and not confess, because then you're going to get 10 years of prison time. So you want to rat the other person out, right? And the absolute best consequence would be to get only 1 year of prison time. But assuming the other person confesses too, you might get a 5 years. If neither prisoner confesses, you get only 2 years. So, there's this kind of adversarial way of reading this situation where you want to outwit the other prisoner at all costs, right? You want to get the best consequences for yourself. If that means ratting out the other person in the process, so be it. And so on. Another way you can look at this situation is to think of it in terms of this tendency to kind of band together and work together as a group, right? If these two prisoners both stick to their guns and collaborate with each other, if they stay a partnership, right, then neither one of them is going to run the risk of getting that 10-year prison sentence. So it's in their best interest to continue collaborating together. It sort of maximizes the benefit, and minimizing the risks of getting that terrible 10-year prison sentence. What's interesting to me, though, is the way in which this scenario cultivates these really not sort of ideal character traits, right? In this case, the logical thing to do kind of from the outside and this collaborative way of sticking to your guns and being a partnership no matter what really encourages, in this case, it encourages you to continue lying and continue cheating and sticking to your guns. The sort of honest virtue would be just to confess, to be honest, to confess, right? But, weighing the consequences in this gamesmanship-like way, actually cultivates the character trait of, yes, it cultivates the character trait of collaboration, but collaborating to continue being conspirators, right? And I guess the reason I bring it up is that it's different from poker. Poker encourages the character traits of being a top dog no matter what, of bluffing your way into meeting your goal, bluffing your way into winning, And for a starship captain, that's important, right? You know, you need to be able to bluff your way out of tricky situations, mm-hmm. and it's important for life. We talked about that already. But it's also important to learn to work together. And it strikes me that this prisoner's dilemma could be a metaphor for learning diplomacy, right? You need to know when your goal should be to try to outwit other people and be a top dog. That's an important trait sometimes. When you're faced with a Romulan off your bow, that's an important skill. But that it's also important when to know when to not be in adversarial mode, when to be in more of a diplomatic mode. When is it in our best interest to work together versus to be adversarial? Mm-hmm. And so the distinction, I think, between poker and these sort of traditional games theory examples like the Prisoner's Dilemma strikes me as it all just strikes me in the category of that situational awareness I mentioned before, that, you know, you do need to know when you need to be adversarial. That's important sometimes. If you don't do that, you're going to get one-upped at every turn of the game. You're not going to move up that career ladder. You're not going to get that promotion. You're not going to sit down at that senior officer's game. You're not going to get that job. You're not going to start that podcast, right? You need to know when to put yourself out there and be very forward about what you want and how to get there, and manipulating and strategizing and all these skills. That's just an important life skill. I don't see how anyone can get very far in life without cultivating something like that.
Right.
But you don't want to be like that all the time. If you approach all of life that way, you're going to set yourself up for a lot of disappointments. You're going to, you know, bump into a lot of furniture and hurt a lot of people along the way. It's important to know that, you know, when you can look at a situation and say, it's actually in our best interest to work together on this, rather than to continue to be adversarial. And it just strikes me that, so that's my big takeaway from the Prisoner's Dilemma. It's different from poker, but it's also an important lesson in this virtue ethics character development sense. You need to know which mode to be in, and poker can't get you all of the way there.
You know, it occurs to me as you're talking about this, Zachary, there's a really good example in TNG, since we're focusing a great deal on TNG episodes. It's not particularly a poker episode, but Chain of Command. There's a really great scene in which Gal Madred, David Warner's brilliant Cardassian character, says to Captain Picard after, you know, seemingly days, perhaps even weeks of torture, you know, he finally opens up the door and tells him, you know, hey, I've gotten as far as I'm going to get with you. I think you're free to go. And Picard gets up slowly and he's making his way towards the door, and Gal Madred lowers his head and says, "We'll just have to get what we need from the female."
Yeah, he bluffs, right?
Yeah. He bluffs. Mm-hmm. And it was a great bluff, too. And it was enough. And you talk about the partnership between Prisoner A and Prisoner B. You know, let's think about this for a second. Picard doesn't realize that Beverly wasn't captured. He doesn't know that she and Worf managed to escape. That's not really brought out. Gal Madred does a brilliant job of letting him know that he's aware of the other two, but doesn't ever really disclose up until this point, you know, what the fate of either of them was. And he tells Picard that, you know, Worf was killed, and they haven't done anything to the female yet. You know, if she cooperates. And it's interesting how that partnership that Picard felt towards Beverly, you know, that he's willing to turn around and go and quietly sit down and just endure, you know, on her behalf. I think that's a beautiful picture of the Prisoner's Dilemma in the Next Generation.
Yeah, you can imagine the inner monologue Captain Picard might have. You know, what if she's already given away the defense codes to Minas Corva? What if she's told mm-hmm. him everything she knows? What if she's not really there? You can kind of go through all of these permutations, just like you would do in this Prisoner's Dilemma example. And I think this is what we do. And, you know, I think humans are just really good at filling in the gaps in with our imagination, right? We can imagine all the different possibilities, all the different scenarios, all the different possible outcomes, and we sit and we weigh consequences. And that's what Picard has to do, right? You know, what if Beverly's still there? What if I give him the defense codes? What if I don't give him the defense codes? What if I'm here my entire life? What if the Enterprise isn't really, in flames above some planet, right? You can map all of these out into some big, grid of consequences and situations. And, you know, what's interesting about the Prisoner's Dilemma, though, is just that the thing that seems most rational, the most rational thing to do, you know, from the sake of getting that 1 year sentence versus the 10 year sentence, would be to say, you know, I'm going to rat the other person out because they're probably going to do the same thing to me. And that's mm-hmm. one possible scenario, right? And yet, you know, from the outside, you sort of go, that's really self-destructive, actually. You're going to end up better consequences if you end up working together as a team, developing this sort of collaborative approach. And of course, you can, you know, the prisoner's dilemma is just a contrived example. But, you know, in a case like you mentioned in that episode of The Next Generation, you know, I'm actually thinking of a different situation, like, you know, we mentioned the Romulan ship hanging off the bow, right? There's a case where you have to decide what mode to be in. You know, if you're trying to put yourself in the mind of the Romulan commander on the other ship, right, you have to ask yourself, what is that person mm-hmm. going to do? Are they going to start a war with me? Are they going to fire on my ship? What's going through their mind, right? And that can be really yes. self-destructive, because you can start to worry that they're going to fire on you. They're going to outwit you. They're trying to sabotage you, whatever the situation is, right? But that can be really self-destructive, and it can lead to a war, these really terrible consequences. You know, the best thing to do would be to say, hey, we need to overcome this situation. We need to work together and not let this devolve into a war. And you don't always have that luxury. So maybe they don't answer your hail, right? Maybe you don't have that easy access. But if you did, you know, a lot of situations aren't like the prisoner's dilemma, right? You know, I think in our minds, we sort of, we take situations, we try to guess what other people are thinking about those situations, right? You know, I'm worried about something. What are they thinking? What are they worried about? And one of the best things you could do is to say, let's sit down and work together and not try to guess what the other person is thinking, right? That's a good strategy in business. It's a good strategy in relationships. It's a good strategy in, you know, for starship captains when you're trying to prevent a war.
Sure.
And I think that those are all lessons you can learn from the prisoner's dilemma, that it pays to work together instead of trying to take this adversarial approach that poker teaches you. But, you know, the prisoner's dilemma is interesting, because in working together, you're still being a co-conspirator in this really negative situation. But I think you could give the kind of the Star Trek version of this, right? Imagine two commanders on the bridge of a starship, each trying to, you know, guess what the other person is thinking. You know, it pays to just, you know, hail the other ship and say, let's sit down and talk to each other. And of course, you have all the questions of honesty. You know, are they bluffing to me when I say let's work together and they tell me everything I want to hear? Are they bluffing? Do they really mean it? And you can go through all these permutations. But just this oscillation back and forth between being in bluffing mode when you're being adversarial, or trying to work together, and how do you really trust mm-hmm. that the other person is being genuine and really trying to work with you? You know, all of this can be done, you know, through games. You know, so here, games are a fascinating metaphor for ethics or decision making, you know, interpersonal relationships, politics. You know, it's really rich stuff to talk about, all acted out before our very eyes in Star Trek.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that I find fascinating is, you know, make no mistake about it, Captain Picard's entrance into the Tuesday night poker game on the Enterprise was certainly not his first sit down at the table. I have no doubt that when he was known as Johnny, the young, brash Starfleet ensign, I have no doubt that
when he didn't yet know how to bluff, right?
When he getting impaled through the heart by Nosigans,
bluffing with that Nosigan too. You
know, I have no doubt he was a master poker player. And you know, again, I'll say it again. All kidding aside, I think that Boothby taught a master poker class at Starfleet Academy, and that's how he mentored these young Starfleet officers. But Zachary, we are rolling past an hour. Any final thoughts on poker and the game of life?
Yeah, nothing I haven't already mentioned, but I think I'll just sort of sum up by saying that, you know, poker, it's used for a metaphor for a great many things in Star Trek. It's used to act out the drama of the particular episode. It's used for character development. It's used to, in this virtue ethic sense, to cultivate different character traits. And, you know, I'm not a poker player. I tend to gravitate towards these more logical games, like you might expect from a guy who used to teach logic, right? You know, I like chess, and I like these sort of deductive, logical type games. But there's a theatrics to poker that's really important, right? When you're in a certain kind of situation, you need to act the part, and you need to, other people need to see you in a certain light. And I think this is what, I think you can see why Captain Picard wouldn't want to join the poker game. You know, if his crew learns, you know, how to tell that he's bluffing, that's not good. You know, you need to stay in that bluffing mode as a commander, right? You can't let them see the magic. You can't let them see the wizard behind the curtain a little bit, right? There needs to be some mystery to it. And that idea that there's always a card hidden in poker that you don't know what it is. There's an ace in the hole. There may not be an ace in the hole. There's an ace in the photon torpedo tube. Whatever it is, right? That's an important part of maintaining control of a situation, and that's important for Captain Picard. So I think it's kind of sad because in order to succeed as a captain, you do have to kind of keep that distance, or as a manager, you know this. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily lead to some ideal character traits. Doesn't lead to the most collaborative approach. Doesn't lead to the most communal approach. And the duality of these sort of competing ideals, the ideal of being in charge and being being in control of a situation, being a good starship commander in that sense, is at odds with the sense of community and these are other values that we have. So what I think of as interesting here is just the sense of competing values, that poker teaches us some of these values. They don't teach us all the values. There are other values that are important. You can shift back and forth between different modes, being more collaborative or being more adversarial, but it's the situational awareness that lets you know which mode to play. And if you haven't cultivated all of those different character traits from all of those different experiences, learning those different games when you're younger, right? Then you can be kind of handicapped in a certain way. You need to be able to know which mode to be in. And I just think it's such an important skill for life. And I've sort of learned over the years that I'm a bit of an existentialist, that you can actually make things happen for yourself. But in my experience, that does kind of involve bluffing, right? You need to be able to talk your way into what you want out of life. You know, if there's a kind of job you want that you're not qualified for yet, you need to be able to talk your way into it. And of course, what you don't want to do is talk your way into it so much that you don't actually learn the skills, or you don't actually learn, you know, you don't want a starship captain that's all bluffing, doesn't really have the big stick of the photon torpedo tube, right? A captain that's just a bluffer is not going to be a terribly effective captain, right? You need to know when to bluff, but you can't bluff all the time. And I think that's just a really important skill, to know when you need to sort of bluff your way into something, when you need to, and hopefully when you're there, you actually learn the skills and learn how to succeed and learn how to thrive. And you're not just all talk and no action. But as I see it, just that's such an important skill, because you really can manufacture the kind of life you want to live. You can manufacture your own career path. You can, if you do it successfully as a starship captain, you can make good decisions and make great things happen in the universe and prevent wars and all these things that starship captains have to do. But if you're not able to bluff, or if you bluff too much, it leads to some disastrous consequences. So I just like the imagery of the ace in the hole always being kind of, you don't really know what's under those cards, and you can really use that to make things happen for yourself. It's just such a rich metaphor for life. In my experience, it's been often tied up with your ability to bluff. And I guess what I don't like is the word bluffing. Bluffing makes it sound really, really negative, right? You know, what you want to be able to do is portray yourself or the situation in the kind of light that you want it to be portrayed in. And there's kind of a marketing skill to that.
You should write that nonsense right there down.
Uh-oh. Is that all nonsense? Uh-oh. We better end this podcast.
Talk about
all nonsense.
Spin.
I guess that's it. It's the art of spin. And there's two ways of looking at it. There's this negative sense that you're all talk and no action. There's no reality to it. There's no substance to it. But then there is using it as a tool to make something real happen in the real world, to get that job, get that promotion, prevent the war. Mm-hmm. The term bluffing maybe just doesn't have the connotations that I think I want to capture there. So there you go. I'm bluffing about the word bluffing. I'm spinning
bluffing
the
about
word spinning.
The word bluff. Indeed.
So there you go. Those are my final thoughts. Bluffing is an important skill for life. There you go.
I concur. You know, I think about games and not just poker, but think about this for
Candyland.
Yeah. We didn't see Candyland in Star Trek, unfortunately. I would have liked to have thought that Candyland and Chutes and Ladders would...
Chutes and Jeffrey's Tubes.
Chutes and Jeffrey's Tubes. And ladders, tubes. Yeah. There we go.
Jeffrey's Tubes and Turpy. Somebody
get Aaron Harvey a message that we need to develop Chutes and Jeffrey's Tubes, a child's game on Star Trek. No, I think about games, though.
Jeffrey's Tubes and Turbo Ladders.
Jeffrey Tubes... Right. Jeffrey's Tubes and Turbo Lifts. I like it. I like it. Aaron Harvey, there you go.
Drop the mic. Our work here is done. Yeah.
Somebody get Parker Brothers on the phone. But think about this for a second. You know, games in Star Trek, you know, Coruscant. I think about Dom Jot and Tongo. Those are some games. Parisi Squares. These are games that were kind of invented in the Star Trek universe. And then, of course, you know, the conventional games. We've talked about poker quite a bit and darts. We see games still being played. I love that aspect of Star Trek, that in the 23rd, 24th century, we're still playing games, and games are essential in teaching life lessons. And I think that's what it's all about. We talked about poker, particularly in Next Generation, and the fact that it is a metaphor. And I don't think it's a happy accident, Zachary, that poker is so prevalent in Star Trek, because I think it is a metaphor for what it's all about. You know, Q says to Picard in All Good Things, you know, that's the exploration that awaits you. Not mapping stars or studying nebula, but charting the unknown possibilities of existence. And I think that's what it's all about. You think about all the different ways that you can play poker. You can make certain cards wild to make the game interesting, or as Worf likes to say, to make it a woman's game.
Yeah, not winning any points with the ladies there.
No. That's a Worf quote. That's not me, ladies. Just being clear there.
Just to be clear. Yeah.
But I think what Captain Picard says, those final words, and the sky's the limit, I think really is what it's all about. When you think about all the possibilities, you know, Spock famously said, there are always possibilities. You think about all the possibilities that can play out in a poker hand or in a game. You can lose a hand and turn around and win big the next time around. You can be sitting there literally with, you know, your last chip. You know, in the game, and you're about out. But you know, if you can bluff your way, or if your hand's strong enough, you know, you can clean house like Data. And that's true in Star Trek, and it's true in life. And so I think with the positive, always optimistic viewpoint of Star Trek, I think poker becomes a really great metaphor for the possibilities that are out there, and the fact that, you know, the sky is certainly the limit. And, you know, I just as a final thought, I'd be interested to hear from our listeners. So, you know, what are your favorite games represented in Star Trek universe, or what games perhaps you would have liked to have seen represented in the Star Trek universe? I'd love to get some feedback on that. So by all means, start a thread in the Babel Conference as you're listening to today's podcast, and let us know, what are your favorite games in the Star Trek universe? What games would you have liked to have seen represented? Love to jump in that conversation. Those are my final thoughts, Zachary.
Yeah, I think you're onto something about seeing possibilities. I think the thing that always strikes me as a little sad, I see it in people I know, I see it in people I've encountered. I see kind of a fatalism, right? You know, they've been dealt a bad hand. And I guess, you know, this is the richness of the metaphor, right? Everyone gets dealt a bad hand sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, and what do you do with that? You can be a fatalist where you just say, fold, and I'm done, and I'm out, and I'm not gonna try to better my situation. Or you can bluff your way into something better. You know, come hell or high water, you're gonna make something out of nothing. And that approach is such a fruitful approach, right? You really can invent something for yourself. You can invent the future. We can invent this world that we love as Star Trek, right? You know, we see the possibilities, you know, let's bluff our way. That's what I want to do. I want to bluff our way into the Star Trek universe, right? You know, we can make it happen because, you know, if we play our cards right. And again, it's just such an interesting metaphor. I don't use it very much really, but now I kind of want to start using it more. So maybe I'll start playing poker, you know, probably not, but there's some poker players out there who have just defended, like, you don't want to play poker. It's not my game. I'll clean house with Monopoly. It's okay.
Jeffrey's Tubes and Turbo Lifts.
Right. Yeah, we just coined a new game, Jeffrey's Tubes and Turbo, or Shoots and Jeffrey's Tubes, I think is probably a good way to put it. You know, we'll argue about the title later. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about the ethics of poker on Star Trek today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The Ready Room.
He's carrying an
the lamb chop sock puppet, saying, "She stayed at her post
while Charlie Horse ran."
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey! And then sexiness ensues, and it's a slow dissolve to the next morning.
Fantastic. Okay. Check. Janeway gets some.
Check. Janeway gets some. Confirmed. Commentary. Trek stars.
You know, you come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
Women at Warp.
AF, which are the initials that Picard carved into Boothby's tree back on Starfleet Academy, and that is how he met Boothby the groundskeeper.
Well, we never did learn Boothby's first and second name, did we? It was all a ploy to get to hang out with Boothby.
Meta Treks.
What I find most interesting is that when Deanna suggests it, Riker doesn't say, "What? That's a crazy idea," or "I've never thought about that." He's just like, "Oh, okay, good idea." And like, it's a normal thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a normal thing to call up something in the holodeck and kind of work through it or live through it.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
Chekhov was in the first season, but he was working on the third deck behind the boiler room and was ill with a condition called Malaprovsky's malady, which is a kind of 23rd century version of Montezuma's revenge, and was hidden in the bathroom, ensconced there for hours and hours, while poor Mr. Khan's genetically engineered kidneys, about to explode, pounded pitifully on the door, begging to be let in, until finally the door opens, Chekhov steps out, Khan looks at him and says, "Your face, I remember."
That's the best explanation I've ever heard.
You get the idea that I've told this story before.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @TrekFM.
And you can also find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/TrekFM. And while you're there, visit us in the Babel Conference. Join the discussion. Type the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at TrekFM and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not losing all your poker chips to Commander Riker, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, you can find me frequently on Warp 5, where I am an associate producer. Also, I've been a frequent visitor to the Ready Room on the interwebs, Facebook, certainly the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. So, Zachary, when you're not practicing your poker face in the mirror, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, likewise, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference, and you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZachareyFruhling. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Reshing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.